The Roman statesman Marcus Tullius Cicero and the German priest Martin Luther didn't have access to Facebook or Twitter, but in their day, they were masters of social media. Long before Marcus Zuckerberg was a twinkle in his mother's eye, there was media, and it was social. That's the argument Tom Standage makes in his book Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years. Standage is also the digital editor of The Economist. Steve Paulson talks with him.
Tom, you say that Martin Luther had his own version of social media in Reformation Europe. In fact, the Protestant revolt against Catholicism would not have been nearly so effective without the intervention of Gutenberg's printing press.
Indeed, he writes this list, the 95 Theses, which are the list of sort of talking points of why he thinks the Pope and the Catholic Church are wrong when it comes to the doctrine of indulgences. And this is about giving the church money in order to get yourself or your relatives out of purgatory. Luther thinks this is all a bit dodgy. So he writes this list of reasons why he thinks it is and says, I want to have a debate about this. And he writes them in Latin, which is the language of theological debate. And he's a theologian at a university in a town called Wittenberg. And he pins this up on the university notice board, which is in fact the church door in Wittenberg, and invites the debate. And this is such explosive stuff that people start to copy it down and send it to their friends. And so some printers get hold of this and they reprint what Luther has come up with, his list. And that means that because a typical print run would be 500 or 1,000 copies, there are suddenly a lot more copies in circulation. And it spreads to other towns, and then printers there get hold of it and reprint it. So a contemporary of Luther tells us that it takes 2 weeks for Luther's list to spread throughout the whole of Germany, and only 4 weeks to spread throughout the whole of Western Europe. And this is astonishing to Luther. It's not what he expected at all. But he senses an opportunity, which is that evidently, if you put something out there that a lot of people agree with, but maybe they can't admit they agree with, they'll spread it on their own. So he follows up with a series of pamphlets written in German, which are much more easily understandable because they're not in theological Latin. Far more people read German, even though the rate of literacy is not all that high. And these pamphlets, he just has to give the text to one printer in his own town. He prints 1,000 copies. They spread to other towns. Printers there reprint them, and so on and so on. And he does this again and again and again. And we've, you know, in the first 10 years of the Reformation, there are something like 5 to 7 million pamphlets flying around. So it's an amazingly effective way for him to spread his message and to galvanize support for the idea that the Catholic Church needed to be reformed. And ultimately, instead of being reformed, the church split. And that is the Reformation.
And you use the phrase going viral. You say Luther went viral. I mean, we tend to think of that as a very modern phenomenon. You're saying it goes way back.
Yes, my tongue is somewhat in my cheek. I've actually plotted Luther's traffic stats. The way we measure the effectiveness of a social media campaign today is, you know, how many times a tweet is retweeted or something on Facebook is liked or something on Tumblr is reblogged or something on Google Plus is plus one, et cetera, et cetera. You can actually count up the number of times that Luther was reprinted. So the number of times a printer got hold of one of his pamphlets and said, this is amazing, I'm going to reprint it and put another 1,000 copies in circulation, in effect retweeting it to the local community.
Which is interesting. I mean, you're saying that Luther himself was not the one who was making all these copies. I mean, he put out a few and then other people were copying. I mean, retweeting really is the proper analogy here.
It really is, because what's happening here is the audience is deciding what's important and amplifying it. And that's why I say this is a social media system. This is not broadcast. And the Catholic Church at the time had broadcast of a kind. It could say to its archbishops, who would say to the bishops, who would say to the local priests, you know, go into the pulpit and say that Luther is terrible. And so they did. And that was a kind of broadcast. But Luther's social distribution was much more effective. And so that's why I say it's social. It's person to person. It's people recommending it to things. It's people going to the printer and saying, have you got the new Martin Luther? It's really great. If you haven't got it, you should find it and reprint it. And then when the printer has 10 people coming to him asking for it, he realizes there's demand. So he prints it. And then when other people go to the printer when he's sold out and ask for it, the fact that there are none left tells them that other people in their town, even if they don't know them, agree with Luther. And this is what modern scholars of media call synchronization of opinion. And it's the way that social media can allow people to discover that the views that they hold, but maybe aren't prepared to announce in public, are actually widely held by other people. And that's what we saw in the Arab Spring. As Luther put it, I gather from the rapid spread of the theses, his list, what the greater part of Germany thinks about indulgences. So the rapid spread of the list told him and the people who was spreading it, that his views were popular. And that's the kind of signaling that social media makes possible.
What's fascinating about this history you are laying out for us is how something different, quite different, happened than later on. I mean, you were not describing the mass media here, the institutions that we tend to know as the major newspapers, as television networks, where the news has gatekeepers and it's centralized and there are professional journalists. And that all came along, what, in the mid-19th century?
Yes, my whole point is that that's a very, very recent phenomenon. So we're used to thinking of the idea that, you know, old media, as we've been calling it, is the way media has always been. And what I'm really trying to do in this book is say, no, if you look at the last 2,000 years, media has been social for most of that period. And it's only in the middle of the 19th century that you start to get what we now think of as mass media. So essentially what happens is you get these machines that are invented, starting with the steam press in the 19th century and then the radio and TV transmitter in the 20th century. And what they do is they allow you to send the same message to a very large audience extremely cheaply, extremely conveniently, whether it's a newspaper with a very large circulation, you can just, you know, print a million copies in a day, or whether you can broadcast your message to millions of people with radio sets or TV sets. The thing about those machines, though, is they're very expensive, so only a few people can have access to them. And there are limits to how many of them there can be. Something like radio, you know, there's only a certain amount of bandwidth. There's only a certain number of radio stations you can have. And so we end up with this very centralized media system, which has, yes, this small priesthood of journalists and politicians and businessmen who have access to it. Then what happens at the end of the 20th century is that the internet makes reaching a very large audience of millions cheap again. So it has been very expensive for a very long time, because you have to like buy all these printing presses and radio towers and establish a media empire. And then suddenly, with things like blogs and social media, you can, in theory, reach an audience of millions of people for little or no cost. And so that does away with this sort of short-term constraint that we had, and the broadcast era and all the business models that arose around it. And that's why we see the media industry in such a mess, you know, the music industry undermined by the internet, the newspaper industry undermined by the internet, and so on. Essentially, they were built on a business model that was based on short-term scarcity and short-term monopoly. And the internet has undone that. So I'm trying to show this larger shape to the history of media. And a consequence of all of this is that the social media we have now is very, very similar to the social media that we had before the mass media era. So the mass media era is the anomaly, the blip that has now come to an end. But what that means is if we rediscover this ancient social media that was going on before the 19th century, we can actually learn a lot about the social media we're using today. It's not unprecedented. It's actually a reversion to the mean, but going back to the way things used to be. And as a result, we can learn from the way people dealt with it in the past.
And yet, on the other hand, as you referred to journalists, they were part of the priesthood. I have to say, I kind of like that idea. I've never thought of myself as being part of the priesthood. And, you know, you're part of that priesthood, too. And, you know, you work for The Economist. The question, of course, is whether we're losing something once we don't rely so much on professionals like journalists who are trained to do this, trained to write well, to disseminate the news with a critical eye. What do you think?
Well, yes, I'm a member of the priesthood, and so are you, and the irony is we're talking about this on the radio, which is all part of this. But I think we have to recognise we're entering a new world here. Broadcast isn't going to go away. Broadcast overshadowed social media for the mass media era, and now they're essentially on pretty much an even footing, I think. But we're seeing the balance, this new hybrid of mass media and social media emerging, and we're all trying to work out how to do it. And so we see mass media organisations trying to work out how to use social media to their best advantage. And so, you know, that's one of the things I'm responsible for at The Economist is, you know, our use of digital media and digital platforms. So that's something that, you know, we're trying to do our best to figure out. We also see social media being used actually in rather a sort of broadcasty way. If you think about how Barack Obama or Lady Gaga use Twitter, they're not actually chatting with their friends on it. They are tweeting millions of people at once. It's very much a broadcast model. So what we see happening now, in fact, is an emergence of a hybrid. And the net result of this is there will be fewer professional journalists in future. I think particularly in the US, there are probably, you know, the number that we had during the mass media boom. I don't know if we're going to have that many in the future.
Tom Standage is the author of Writing on the Wall, Social Media of the First 2,000 Years. He spoke with Steve Paulson.